Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, welcome to New Books in Music, a podcast of the New Books Network. I'm Kristen Turner, and my guest today is Mark Katz, professor of music at UNC Chapel Hill. But for the purposes of our interview, more importantly, he's the founder and former director of Next Level, a cultural diplomacy program administered through the U.S. State Department. His new book about this project and the complexities of people-to-people exchanges is called Build, The Power of Hip-Hop Diplomacy in a Divided World. Thank you so much for joining me today, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you are a hip-hop scholar, so I guess it makes sense if you're going to do a cultural diplomacy project that you would use hip-hop as the sort of culture part of that. But perhaps as an academic, it's not so obvious why you would even get involved with cultural diplomacy to begin with. So I thought we could start with maybe if you could just tell us a little bit about what Next Level is, how it got started, what is a residency, how does it work, all of that, just to give us all a starting place.
Sure. So Next Level is the name of a cultural diplomacy program that is funded by the State Department, particularly the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, also known as ECA, which is the bureau within the State Department that funds all exchanges and all cultural programming. The Fulbright program is their best known program in the bureau. And Next Level is in the tradition of programs that go back for decades, but the most recognizable one would be what was unofficially known as the Jazz Ambassadors Program. And that started in the 50s when the State Department began sending famous U.S. jazz artists like Dizzy Gillespie, he was the first, and then Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and others around the world during the Cold War as representatives of this country. And the purpose of any kind of cultural diplomacy is to connect the connect different nations through the platform of culture. And that could be visual art, it could be dance, it could be music, it could be food, poetry, literature, and so on. And hip-hop diplomacy in particular is a form of cultural diplomacy in which hip-hop is that platform that is meant to connect people of different countries. And there's another term that is useful to know, which is people-to-people diplomacy. And that's a form of diplomacy that is different from what might be called official diplomacy, where it is official representatives of a country who interact. So ambassadors, diplomats, ministers, and so on. So the people who connect through hip-hop diplomacy and any kind of people-to-people diplomacy are citizens who are not employees of the State Department. They're not government workers. They're not foreign service officers. So Next Level is a program that has been around since 2014, and it sends teams of U.S. hip-hop artists representing different elements within hip hop, rapping, dancing, DJing, beatboxing, graffiti art. And they go to different countries, particularly underserved communities within countries, for 2-week residencies. And each artist runs a workshop in their respective disciplines. And at the end of the 2 weeks, everyone comes together and they mount a public performance. And we leave behind equipment and for the community to be able to continue their work. And we continue the relationship afterwards. But since 2014, we've now been to over 30 countries on 6 different continents.
So how many residencies does that come out to? Is that 30 different residencies as well or more?
Yes. Yes, that's right. I think it's 30 or 31. Right now, I think Ethiopia is the latest one. The most recent that has been completed was Mongolia. There's a residency coming up in Ethiopia, and then Peru and Bolivia and Nepal are filling out this cycle. So each cycle, there are five to seven countries that we visit. And only occasionally do we go to more than one country during residency. So we've been to, I think, 32 countries and 31 residencies.
So how are the countries chosen or the cities of residency? Is that up to Next Level or is that up to the State Department?
Well, it's both. In the end, it's the State Department's decision. But the way it works now that we've done it for several cycles is that the beginning of the cycle, the team of people who run Next Level, and that was me and a small group of managers, would come up with a list of maybe 10 to 12 countries in different regions in the world and explain why we think it would be a good country to go to. And the criteria include, you know, is there a robust hip hop community? Are there, is this a country we haven't been to before? Are there connections we might make between this country and neighboring countries that we've been to? and then in terms of the State Department, they have a variety of interests. One is coming from the embassies. So the embassies might request a hip hop program. So there are a lot of things going on. It's this kind of negotiation in a sense. We come up with some suggestions. Then the people that we work with at the State Department talk to some people within, they call them the cultural coordinators for each of the bureaus and the regional bureaus. So for example, there's the Middle East and North African Bureau, or there is the Western Hemisphere Bureau. So there are some sort of ideological reasons. Is this a place where we can help strengthen U.S. Or the image of the U.S.? There are practical reasons. Has there been a lot of cultural programming in this country? And then there are particular hip hop reasons. Are there really vibrant hip hop scenes in this country?
So once you start, or I guess when you're planning a residency and you're there, how do you identify who you're going to work with and who's going to be both part of the program from the American side and who is going to be participating from the host country's side? How does all that work?
From the American side, we have an application process. And in fact, for our 7th cycle, what we call Next Level 7.0, we have just gotten all the applications in. We got, I can't remember exactly, but maybe about 150 applications. We're going to have 20 slots available. And so we put out a call for applications. It's very competitive, and word has gotten out that this is a strong program that a lot of people have recommended to others. And so we get applications, and they have to explain things like what is their educational philosophy. They have to provide work samples so we can see their rapping or their graffiti art or their beat making and so on. And then there's a panel that selects them, mostly hip hop artists, but also some people from the State Department review those applications as well. So we pick, we're doing that right now. And then once we have all the countries selected, then we contact the embassies or consulates in that country, and we start there. Usually the diplomatic posts have local connections with NGOs, with schools, with performing arts organizations, and often they will suggest a number of potential partners that we might work with. And we do an advance trip where we go there and meet with these potential partners and decide who we think we would work best with. And then in terms of the residency, it's the local partner that puts out a call for participation on their side. So they'll put out things on social media or in the regular media calling for, it's usually young people between 15 and 25, to see if they want to participate. And these programs are all free. They don't have to have any experience. They just have to be committed to showing up every day and having an interest in hip hop.
So you, it's interesting that you have such a large cohort of people wanting to participate, because as you point out, hip hop and diplomacy on the behalf of the U.S. government are not exactly the first pair of ideas that I would necessarily put together. I mean, you think about hip hop, there's a long history of sort of real critiques of the United States, U.S. policy. A lot of people who are involved in hip hop are from marginalized communities here in the United States. And then frankly, on the other side of the equation, that's often true in the global hip hop community. A lot of people who are part of that are also marginalized in their own countries. So, I am surprised that it's so popular. You know, what do hip hop artists here? What's their reasoning for wanting to do this, and how do they sort of deal with the political ramifications of being part of a government program?
It's a good question. And there's no doubt that, as far as I can tell, every hip hop artist who has participated in Next Level has come in with some concerns, not necessarily about the program itself, but about just the fact that they are getting paid by the government to do this. And no one goes into this without having some questions and concerns. The reason why people do this, and I've interviewed maybe 150 people for this book, and I asked them this question. And there are what I call both internally motivated and externally motivated reasons that they sign up for this. So internally, it's how they serve themselves. So Next Level and programs like it offer something very unusual, which is a way to travel the world and get paid for it and to do it as an artist. For many artists of any type, and hip hop artists are no exception, that is a dream, to be able to see the world and to do it as an artist. There are very few opportunities for anyone to do that. This is one opportunity, and it's paid, and it pays pretty well. It's a way to travel. It's a way to travel as an artist. It's a way to connect with people around the world. To find new sources of artistic inspiration. So these are very powerful motivations. Another is representation. People feel very, very strongly about representing hip hop, about representing their gender or their region, their community to the world. So these are some of the things that I call internal motivators. And then the more outwardly directed or external motivators are about serving others. A lot of the people I work with are activists, and they feel like they can do good in the world through hip hop. And if they can do a project that brings them into contact with underserved communities around the world that might help budding hip hop artists create careers, that might allow young people to express themselves in constructive, powerful, healing ways, they want to do that. So this is really just an unusual opportunity to be able to do all these things. So that doesn't mean that these artists don't wonder about what they're getting themselves into. And so the way they manage that, and the way we being the ones who run the program manage it, is that we have to do this with integrity. We have to do this with our eyes wide open. We have to recognize the history of this country in terms of its oppression of its own people, particularly people of color, as well as its unwanted intervention in places around the world, and be open about that. So it's tricky, but people feel like, the people who do this feel like they can do this with and maintain their integrity. And if they can do that, they're not selling out.
I guess I asked it earlier, but then I realized we sort of got into other parts of the conversation. How did you get involved? Like, you know, so those are the artists and their sort of reasoning. What was your reasoning to get involved in this?
Well, there's a very specific reason, which is a rapper I know named Pierce Freelon told me about it and said, the State Department is putting out a call for applications to create this program. So I wasn't commissioned to do this. They didn't reach out to me. There was a call for proposals. So it was a grant application. And he told me about this, and I applied and got it. And he helped me with the, we actually co-wrote the application. But the reason why this came up at all is that he and I and other hip hop artists had been collaborating over the past few years here at UNC Chapel Hill in a number of courses that I had created, the art and culture of the DJ, beatmaking lab, rap lab. And so over the past several years, starting in maybe 2000, 2007, 2008, I'd been teaching hip hop classes, and then I'd been co-teaching them with hip hop artists, and he was one of those artists. So I had been researching hip hop since about 2000, had been teaching it since a little bit after that, had been collaborating with hip hop communities since 2005 or so, or even before that. So this was an extension of my work, both as a scholar and as a collaborator with the with the hip hop community.
I think it's probably fair to say, certainly based on reading your book and we know each other and have for a while, I think you probably share some of the concerns that the hip hop artists have shared with you as well about how to be ethical in doing this. And a lot of what runs through the book is this sort of constant self-reflection about how should the people in Next Level sort of exist as Americans in another country, trying to work within this cultural diplomacy framework, and how complicated that becomes when you're working in countries that sometimes have really long, fraught histories with the U.S., where our current foreign policy objectives and statements can really impact those countries in a negative way. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what makes a Next Level residency challenging in that way?
there are so many challenging things, but one sort of broad point I'll make is that the work that I've done with Next Level and in writing this book has made me realize that these issues are not at all unique to cultural diplomacy or hip hop diplomacy. I come to think about these issues of agency and complicity and American exceptionalism all the time, and they're relevant to everyone, every American citizen. And these power asymmetries, the differential between the U.S. and other countries in terms of military power, economic power, and so on, is something that everyone should be concerned about. So the issues that I've come across aren't unique, but in terms of how to run a successful residency, we do a lot of work ahead of time to make that happen, and we have a list of principles that we try to abide by and constantly reinforce. And I do print those out in the book, but they include things like show respect for others when you're in other countries, be humble, listen as much as you speak, learn as much as you teach, be self-aware, recognize your privilege, and so on. So there are things that really any good citizen of the world should try to follow, but they're particularly challenging for Americans because of our history, because of our embrace of our own exceptionalism. And there's a long history of American intervention that was uninvited by the countries in which we intervened. There is the ugly American stereotype, which has a certain amount of truth to it. So it's one thing I say and that I tell the artists is I think at heart, it's about being self-aware. It's about being aware of who you are, what you represent, what your power is, how your actions can be received by others, and self-awareness and self-reflection. I think those are key.
You related in the book that a friend told you, I think it was actually the friend's father said to him, and then he says to you, there will never be a small white man in Africa. And I thought that was such a telling comment that, you can never, you can never get away from the sort of the consequences of being white or being American in these spaces. And one of the things you do confront is not only are you an American, but you're also white, working with a lot of Black artists and, coming from a privileged background as being, middle class and being part of a powerful academic institution. Can you talk a little bit about sort of how you see yourself working within all these power dynamics that you relate in the book?
Yes, that statement also really hit home. There will never be a small white man in Africa, in part because I don't think of myself as powerful. I think, just visually, I'm not a big guy. I don't, make a lot of noise. I'm pretty modest. I think of myself as not intimidating. And I've thought of that, in terms of being a professor, but the reality is, I do have power, and I even, with the best of intentions, I can be intimidating, or I can send the wrong message. And this has been very important for me personally to realize because it goes against what I think about myself as a, kind of not particularly powerful or imposing or intimidating person. What I had to really kind of set aside is that kind of self-image and realize, and not try to, not in the sense of trying to exude power, but realize that even so, I am still powerful and I represent power. I represent a powerful nation. And I have to remember that as I'm moving through these spaces in countries where where the U.S. has intervened, or where there is a history of colonization, maybe not by the U.S. but by European countries, where there white people represent unwanted foreign powers. And actually, this occasionally I'm reminded of this when I was in Congo. I was walking down the street and I just heard people shouting Mzungu at me, which I think literally means outsider or foreigner, but particularly, white man. And just my presence was unwanted. Because there's so many peacekeepers there that don't actually help, and there are NGOs that are actually do a lot of damage. And another UNC professor, Cherie Ndoleko, has written about this in her book Necessary Noise. So is actually her husband, Petna Ndoleko, who is a Congolese filmmaker, who told me this story. So I give a lot of credit to Cherie and Petna and the people that I work with for helping me understand my privilege and understand my place and understand power relations.
You do tell some wonderful, really interesting stories and anecdotes to sort of illustrate your points. And one of them I thought was interesting, you have sort of a series of stories like the one you just told that sort of illustrate how people in the countries that you visit are very aware of those power differentials, and that's something that they live with all the time. But then you have some stories where you sort of expect to confront that, and then that's not what happens. I think there was one story about a man in El Salvador. Can you think of some times when you were surprised that that wasn't as much of an issue as you'd anticipated?
Yes, I think the my time in El Salvador was telling, and for me, because I had read up on El Salvador, and I, as I do with every residency, I try to learn as much as I can about that country, and particularly about the U.S. relations with that country. And the U.S. has done, really done terrible things in El Salvador, helping undermine the country, supporting a civil war, helping cover up and even train death squads. Really terrible things that every U.S. citizen should be ashamed of that their country did, and we're certain. And El Salvador is not the only country. So, when I went to El Salvador, I was kind of on guard. Are they going to say "Gringo, go home," "Yankee, go home"? But that wasn't the case. They were very welcoming, and really appreciated our presence there. And I pushed a bit on this, that was very enlightening for me, because what I realized is that the people that I was working with, for the most part, cared much more about where their rent was going to come from, where their next meal was going to come from, if they were artists, whether they would be able to record that album they wanted. It's not like they were unaware of politics, but as an academic, I can get so wrapped up in things like issues like imperialism and globalization, that I forget about the realities of life. And so that was a great reminder to me about, to try to understand people from their perspective, not to impose my expectations on them, and try to meet them where they are. And then it was also very interesting to learn in El Salvador and elsewhere that the U.S. Embassy's presence was a validating force for them, because they would say this is true all over the world. They would say, "Oh, my parents think that I'm a, because I'm into hip hop, I'm a thug, or I just smoke weed all the time, I'm up to no good. But you coming in here with the U.S. Embassy and paying for this this program, and they see that that we're performing under the banner of the U.S. Embassy, that's actually gotten me a lot of respect with my family." So that was very unexpected too. So this power that we carry has so many unexpected consequences. And you just have to go in with your eyes open and try to listen to people and find out what their stories are.
In addition to sort of the complexities that you dig into about, you know, what we've been talking about, these issues of power imbalance and the, you know, history of the United States and how we have related to the world and how that impacts you, there's also the issue of this, the complexity of cultural diplomacy at all, and sort of the tension between what musicians and people in hip hop want to accomplish and what art accomplishes and how the process of what it means to accomplish something in art, and then what diplomats want and what the State Department wants and what does it mean to have an objective that you're trying to accomplish in diplomacy, and how, you know, those things are sometimes not aligned at all, and what happens there. Can you talk a little bit about sort of that tension between the culture and the diplomacy part of cultural diplomacy?
I think of cultural diplomacy in terms of a very complex Venn diagram. So imagine some overlapping circles, each circle representing the agenda of a different group or a constituency. So you have the State Department in general, or the U.S. government, and then you might have even a different circle for the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. You have a circle that represents the U.S. artists, a circle that represents the artists in the countries we visit, or you could have a circle that represents, you know, art in general. And the way I see it is that they do overlap, but there are certainly large areas where they don't overlap. And our goal is to find the areas where they do overlap, and where they don't overlap is in terms of outcomes. The goal of a lot of these programs from the State Department's standpoint or the embassy standpoint is, well, we want to improve the image of the U.S. and we want, to be blunt, we want people to hate us less, and we don't want people to bomb us or we don't want terrorists coming to attack us. Most artists, when they create a piece of art, are not thinking about that as the desired outcome. They want to connect with people. They want to express themselves. So there is that tension about outcomes. What do the artists want to come out of this? What do the diplomats and the the civil servants want to get out of this? So there is that tension. One way I describe it is between process and product. And in a way, it's not totally fair, because I wouldn't want to say that the State Department just cares about the end product and the artists only care about process. But that tends to be where things generate friction. So, for example, I talk about a concert that happened in Morocco that the ethnomusicologist Kendra Salwa told me about, where there were Americans and Moroccans performing together. And from the State Department standpoint, the embassy watching it, it was a success, because you had artists from different countries performing on the same stage. You had a cheering crowd. You had lots of people watching it. It was, you know, thumbs up, you know, mission accomplished. The problem was that there was a lot of friction on stage. They didn't get to practice together. They didn't have time to rehearse. So they didn't really understand how each other operated on a stage and what constituted sharing the stage, what they each thought about audience interaction. So that concert actually generated tension between the artists, which is not what you want. So the way to solve this, though, it's not inevitable that this should happen. And this, I took this as a lesson that I incorporated Next Level, is that there should never be a concert in which people perform where they haven't met before, where they haven't had the chance to get to know each other. And no one should be required to perform together. So we will have these meetups in, you know, behind the scenes where U.S. artists and local artists at wherever we visit get together and jam. And if it works, great. Maybe we'll continue. If it doesn't, if they aren't clicking, the chemistry isn't there, we'll say, well, that was, thanks for, getting together. But we would never push them to perform together. So so that's how we try to navigate these different agendas.
The last chapter of the book is called Build and Destroy, Hip-Hop, U.S. Diplomacy, and Islam. And it's a little different from the other chapters because you are focusing on one particular aspect and one particular community that Next Level often works with. And I was just wondering, why did you pull out that particular community? And, I don't know, what were your motivations for deciding that you needed to really hone in on that, on the Muslim community and your and Next Level's work in that community?
Well, what I realized early on is that the State Department was sending us particularly to countries that had majority Muslim populations. So just in the first cycle, we went to Senegal and we went to Bangladesh. We also went to India, which is not a majority Muslim country, but I think has one of the largest Muslim populations in the world. So they were specifically sending us to these countries that had large Muslim populations. And since, since then, we've gone to many more. I would say maybe, a third or slightly more than a third of the countries we've gone to have Muslim majority populations. So one is simply the fact that we kept going to these countries. The other is simply that as I learned more about the history of hip-hop diplomacy, that it really came to life after 9/11 and that it was not always, but often specifically directed at improving relations between the U.S. and Muslim majority countries. And it's a fascinating history because a lot of what the U.S. is trying to do is to try to repair damage that it itself has done. So the this country, in the wake of 9/11, just did so much damage to its relationship with Muslim populations through through military interventions, through torture, it's I think a fairly shameful part of our country's history is its Islamophobic streak, and this has come up again in it comes up very often, but most strikingly with the executive order that President Trump issued that was essentially a ban against Muslims entering this country. So I guess I felt that I just couldn't ignore it. And it was always in the background if it wasn't in the foreground. And I just wanted to know more about what the people in Indonesia or Tunisia or Algeria or Egypt or Bangladesh thought about what we were doing and what, if any, connection they saw between hip hop and Islam.
Well, you tell in the book that actually there is some really interesting intersections between hip hop in America and Islam and the sort of early history of hip hop. Do people that you work with, so I didn't know much about that, so that was interesting for me to learn about, but do you find that that's something that people that you work with in Muslim communities are aware of, or is that sort of, maybe you could talk a little bit about those connections and then how much that's widely known today?
Sure, that's a complicated issue because The history of hip hop in the US is very much influenced by a particular group within US Islam, and that's the Nation of Islam, but in particular, what's known as the 5% nation, or the 5%ers. And this is not the way that most Muslims practice Islam. So it is, it's quite a bit different. And this particular, in many ways, not in every way, but it's a distinctive practice that is distinctive to the U.S. So there are many hip hop artists that I know that I've worked with who are 5%ers themselves. It's how they would, they might identify themselves. But I remember talking to one rapper, really amazing rapper, who's also a 5%er, and asked him, you know, how would you feel about connecting with Muslims in other countries? And he was like, well, you know, I'd want to be careful because there are things that we do that in the 5% nation that other Muslims don't. For example, people will use Allah as a name for themselves, whereas in other traditions that would be considered offensive. And one thing that this just, there's an obvious point to be made here, which is that not all Muslims think alike. There are different sects, there are different traditions, there are different countries that have very different histories of Islam. And so we can't think of Islam as monolithic. So, but I will say that the State Department people that I worked with were largely or all unaware of this history in the U.S. I don't know how well it's known outside the country. So it was always an interesting thing when we would have Muslim artists, and we do have Muslim U.S. Muslim artists, how they would relate to Muslims in other countries. For the most part, I think the artists that we worked with were not 5%ers. But I would say all of the Muslim artists that we worked with felt very deeply connected to the communities that they worked with. There is one artist who just wrote beautifully to me about her experience in Bangladesh, which was her first experience in a Muslim majority country. She had never been in a place where everyone, or pretty much everyone that she encountered, was Muslim. She had never been to a country where the call to prayer would be sounded five times a day. And she tells this story of waking up at 5 a.m. for the first cycle of prayers and never feeling as moved or as powerful or as connected to God as she did at this moment, because she was in a place where everyone shared her faith. And she talked about, her tears, you know, raining down on the prayer rug as she listened to the call for prayer in Dhaka, Bangladesh. So it's very complicated, but it's also it can be very powerful, this connection that can be made between people who share a faith.
You touched on it a bit in your answer that, or in your answers in the last couple minutes, that the foreign policy of the United States has changed quite a bit since you started Next Level, or started working with Next Level. And, you know, just the number of people working in the State Department has changed. I mean, the department's much smaller now. It has very different kind of leadership. Obviously, our president is quite different from Barack Obama. And you take that on in the book. You're very open about that. You know, things have changed since you started. Can you talk a little bit about sort of what are the changes that you've noticed sort of both on our end in terms of working with the State Department and how the State Department is functioning, but also how are, you know, do you see changes in how people treat treat you in another, treat the delegations and residencies in other countries since President Trump was elected?
Well, I would say one of the surprising things is how little things have changed. And in part because we work with civil servants and foreign service officers, for the most part, rather than political appointees. And they are supposed to be nonpartisan, not bipartisan, but nonpartisan. They work for the country. They do serve the president and the secretary of state, who are obviously political figures, but their ultimate service is to the country. And they take that very seriously. It's almost an oath that they will be nonpartisan. So the people that I work with, their attitudes towards this program of Next Level have not changed because of who is on the seventh floor in the Secretary of State's office or who's in the White House. They have been just as supportive as they ever have. Now, where things have changed is when we go overseas and the way people ask questions. And I remember when Trump was elected, we would go to countries. Sometimes people would almost be a litmus test. They would just say, "Oh, you're American, Obama or Trump," and try to get a sense of where our allegiance fell or stood. And or they would come out and say, "I love America. I love American TV, films. I love hip hop, but your government just is terrible, or your president is crazy." And so we got especially in the Muslim majority countries, it's like, why does your country do this to us? What have we done to deserve this? And it was, and I noticed that, but it did, for the most part, it did not affect their willingness to work with us because we may represent the country and its government, but really the way people see us is representing hip hop. And one interesting thing, unexpected point of solidarity is around a resistance to Trump, because a lot of hip hop artists don't like Trump and have been vocal about that. And in a lot of places we go to, they don't like Trump either. It's not universal. There have been places where people have said that they like Trump or admire him, but there's been an interesting form of solidarity between the U.S. artists and the people that we work with around their resistance to Trump.
That's fascinating. So the State Department does not say, well, if someone asks you a political question as part of that sort of nonpartisanship, they don't tell you to sort of keep, not you particularly, but the people involved to keep their own political opinions to themselves as well? Or because I would think that nonpartisanship would sort of extend to you as well.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, it doesn't have to. And I do feel free. Unlike the State Department people, to say what I want about the government or about our president. Generally, I avoid it because it's not productive. It can be a distraction. Frankly, I don't want to talk about Trump. I want to talk about hip hop, or better yet, I want to make it possible for people to make art. So, for the most part, people don't really want to get into that. But what we're told is that the artists should not feel like they have to speak on behalf of their government. They should just speak from their own perspective, whatever that might be. Now, they do say that and kind of encourage us to stay away from politics when we don't feel equipped to talk about it. So now, people might say, well, what do you, this doesn't happen often, but occasionally we're always interviewed by local media, and occasionally they'll say, well, what do you think about Tunisia? Or what do you think about Algeria? And And they might say, well, what do you think about, the precedent? And that's always kind of a trap. Never answer that question, like their precedent. I mean, the thing is, we're just not well equipped to answer that question. So I was on national TV, a morning show in Algeria, and they asked me what I thought about Algeria. It wasn't a political question, but I talked about, the musical traditions, the food, the art, and how much I appreciated their hospitality. There was just no particularly good reason for me to, bring up, politics in that sense. Now, that doesn't mean we're censored or we can't talk about it, but for the most part, it's not part of the conversation that we have or really want to have.
Well, that does bring up another issue, which is, you are coming into this new country. There's no way that you can become, a sudden expert on Algeria or wherever. Do you ever find yourselves sort of getting plopped into local tensions or local conflicts that you know very little bit about, but yet you find it's really important to the people that you're collaborating with that makes the collaboration difficult or makes your work richer or more challenging? I mean, or are there ways that you can sidestep that? I mean, how does that all that work?
Well, we can't always sidestep conflict. And I talk about a few examples in the book where we just couldn't. We didn't know what we were getting into. And usually it's not so much about politics. It's usually about more local matters. So, for example, when we were in Uganda, I didn't know this, but there are different factions of rappers. One, the Yuga Flow rappers, who rhymed in English, and then the Luga Flow rappers who rhymed in local languages. There was a beef between them, a kind of long, simmering or not so, some maybe boiling over occasionally. And there were representatives from both factions in the workshops, and we didn't know this. Now, this turned out really well, because part of the problem was that these groups wouldn't interact with each other. Our presence gave them an opportunity or an excuse to be in the same space. And I asked someone about this once I learned about this conflict, and he said, we're almost never together, but this has been a great opportunity. And we realized, actually, we're brothers. We shouldn't be fighting. We can get along. And so this was a great example of where our presence kind of unwittingly helped transform conflict. But there are other times when we can generate conflict. And I give the example of going to Croatia, where there was some tensions between, I would call it the underground dance scene and the more commercial dance scene. And that the organization we worked with was a professional dance studio that focused on ballet and contemporary dance, and with a little bit of hip hop. And the underground hip hop artists did not like that we were working with them, because they regarded them as commercial or inauthentic, and didn't like that they were getting all the embassy's resources. The problem is there was no other studio that we could have worked with. So we did our best to navigate this, and we spent a lot of time working with the underground artists. And I think in the end it worked out fairly well. But I know that there are people who didn't show up, who would have come to the workshops if we weren't working with this studio. Maybe people who wouldn't come to the concert because of that. So that was. That was unavoidable. We did our best, but there are times that our presence actually helps generate conflict as well.
So you are no longer the director of Next Level, and you've written this book now. So are you going to continue working with this project, or are you going to move on to other things and let Next Level, grow without you? What is your next move?
Well, Next Level is growing without me as director, but I'm still involved. I had a, I tried to do this very intentionally where I didn't just say, okay, I'm done. Let someone else figure out how to do this. But I worked with people that I had been working with for years and bring them into the administration of it and taking on Junius Brickhouse, who is a wonderful artist and educator and leader, as an associate director, then being co-directors with him, and then stepping down, and after which he became director. So I stay in touch because I think I can, well, they want me to, because just of my institutional memory, and they'll ask, well, you know, has this happened before? Or what happened when we did this? Or what happened in El Salvador? So my position now is where I'm, I guess I'm an advisor, and I go on a few trips a year where what I'll do is my new role is both as an advisor and a kind of liaison with embassies, because I have a decent amount of experience now talking with, you know, diplomats and foreign service officers, but I also bring in my, my role as a professor. I'm the only professor represented, in Next Level, and particularly the administration of it. So I give lectures on the history of hip hop diplomacy. So I'm involved, but Next Level under Junius is evolving in some great ways. He's been instituting some really interesting refinements and innovations that I'm not a part of, but I really appreciate. So I would say, I'm involved as much as either party wants us to be involved. So I will continue to be involved because I love this program. I'm very committed to it, but I'm not involved in any important decision making, and that's really what Junius is doing. In terms of what's next, I always have way too many projects going on at the same time. One is a long overdue book for Oxford University Press for their very short introduction series. And this is going to be on music and technology. So it was due already. I'm going to try to finish it this year. So that's one thing I need to get off my plate. But I'm very interested in future projects that connect or that focus on art and the social good. And this will certainly involve hip hop. You know, I've done projects separate from Next Level that connected hip hop and public health, hip hop and linguistics. So I want to continue to explore the ways that art in general and hip hop in particular can, you know, just to be kind of, really Pollyannish, do good in the world.
Well, thank you very much for taking time to talk to me today. My name's Kristen Turner. This is the New Books in Music, a podcast of the New Books Network. And we've been talking to Mark Katz about his new book from Oxford University Press, Build the Power of Hip Hop Diplomacy in a Divided World.